Good evening, everyone. I'm Trish England, and welcome to Race Talk with Trish, sponsored by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. Guess what? All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com. We've got a really special event tonight. We have four well-known automotive and racing writers. Let me switch over here. Okay. How many of you have a wall full of racing books in your home? Do you consider yourself a collector? Then I'll bet some of your beloved tomes came from one or all of our guests tonight, and I'll introduce them alphabetically. Sean Cridlin, being this award-winning racing photojournalist, magazine writer, and Porsche guy, has turned out a three-volume masterpiece from his secluded home in the high desert. It's called Brumos, an American racing icon, which was an exhaustive labor of love and determination that overcame the pandemic. It is an example of his approach to every facet of his professional life. And we have Jonathan Ingram. When Jonathan starts a new book, he falls in love with his subject. Each one is an influential breaker of barriers, such as Bob Riley and Danica Patrick, or the innovative Panos Roadster, the international hero Dale Earnhardt, or the revolutionary safety concept, the Hans device. He gets down to the nitty-gritty with detail, character, and history. His latest book tells the story of Bill Lester, a friend and an inspiration. Bert Levy.
I'm back.
You are. May I present the Mark Twain of the octane world? Bert writes from experiences in and around racing and all its diverse characters and tales. His four-volume Last Open Road series made him a household name in the race shop set. Other books followed, including The Potside Companion, with its funny and revealing little stories, considered essential reading for any petrol head with indoor plumbing. This man's agility with phraseology is astounding and will catch you off guard. George Levy, what in the world has this man not done? When did he ever find the time to write his long list of books on racing, as well as his Civil War histories? Editor of Auto Week, president of the Motorsports Hall of Fame, articles in all the right magazines, world traveler, alongside his late friend, the photographer Pete Biro. He's a walking lifetime achievement award. We're lucky to grab him for 90 minutes. Each one of these writers is completely different in their styles, approaches to their subjects, and their reasons for writing. Documentary, historical fiction, biography, and hard journalism. But they all want to entertain, amuse, excite, and educate their racing audiences. So sit back and enjoy their stories, and they go out and buy lots more books. And to our audience, please mute your phones, and we'll get started. Ha! All right.
Okay.
I'm going to throw a question out, and whoever grabs it first, grab it. What were you doing before you became a writer?
I was spending way too much money on trying to go racing out of my own pocket.
Okay, so I kind of guess this is Bert.
Yeah, it's got to be.
Okay.
I had always wanted to race cars. I started, I was pretty good. I thought I was really good, but I was just pretty good. And I had when my wife and I got married, we opened a sports car shop, Mellon Motors in Chicago. And that was going to be my base of operations for my meteoric racing career. And then I kind of ran out of money and I ran out of credit. And we were on our way back from the SCCA runoffs in 1983. That was the only year I ran nationals, qualified for the runoffs, and I'm on my way back. Every credit card is at the red line, and I'm thinking to myself, I got to find a different way to do this. And I started writing, actually, George, my first story that I ever sold to a real magazine or a national magazine was to Auto Week. It's about a TR3 we had when I was young. And I started writing about vintage racing, and people started offering me cars to drive to do stories. And I thought, you know, this is better than running my own car. So that's how I got started. Somebody else?
Well, this is Jonathan. You know, I guess Bert's story answers a question I had, which is how do you create a sympathetic character like Buddy Colombo in the last open road? So your background story there is very helpful. You know, my background story is that, you know, from the time I was 12 years old and reading Playboy magazine in the closet and enjoying the stories there, then I
you actually read the stories?
Yeah, there were some good fiction stories in there, you know, popular fiction. And so I always wanted to be a writer, so that just led to sports writing. And because I didn't want to cover golf, they sent me motor racing, and that's how I got involved from a newspaper as a sports writer at the Durham Morning Herald. So that was always the goal, to make my living as a writer. And I guess I'm lucky I didn't try to go racing behind the wheel, because I learned very quickly that is extremely challenging. And after a number of years, the book offers just began to come in. So that's how I started writing books, because I was in the marketplace and had established a name for myself as a journalist. And then the motor racing book business was kind of taking off, and that was around 2000. So that's how I got started. The first five books I did, publishers called me. So I was, you know, fortunate to be kind of in the right place at the right time. So that's my story.
Next time I see you, you're going to get a black eye for that. We went looking for publishers, and every one of them turned us down.
Hello?
Yeah, it's not easy, and those are the first five. Okay, I've done seven since, so I know that story.
Are you self-publishing now?
Are you asking me?
Jonathan.
Well, I'd like to hear everybody else's story, but I've pretty much done all the routes, and I'm, you know, currently, you know, working on books. But yeah, almost all the avenues that you can pursue I have pursued, and I've gotten my black eyes, trust me.
Okay. Who's next?
George Duffy.
Okay. George?
Hi there.
Hello. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. The question was, what were you doing before you wrote your first book?
Oh, a whole lot of things, but you know, I'd been editor of Auto Week for a number of years, and then I spent a fair amount of time in the advertising business, mainly on motorsports accounts.
There was something about a unique skiing exhibit on the
south flat. Oh, you're talking to me now. This is Sean Cridland here, I think.
Oh, okay. All right. Y'all, don't mess with my head now. I'll get confused.
Okay. So this is Sean Cridland. And so before I started, before I did any books, I had a career in ski racing, which had some interesting stuff, because I was involved in speed skiing, which is skiing over 120 miles an hour. And then I think the episode that you were referring to was on the Bonneville Salt Flats, where I was training for aerodynamics on top of the Vesco Streamliner at 162 miles an hour through the mile. When that ended, I ended up in academia for a number of years. And then at one point when I was homeless and jobless, I bought a Porsche. That took me into the Porsche world and gradually started submitting articles and so on. And at one point I had this idea for a book about Peter Gregg, and I met Hurley Haywood, who promised he would help if he could. When nothing developed out of that, I called him to say, hey, thanks for your help, but it's not happening. And Hurley said, well, nobody's done a book on me. And so that's how I began. And the next thing you know, Hurley and I started working on his book, and we weren't having any luck with publishers. So at one point I just said, well, how hard could it be? And, of course, the simple answer to that is hard.
Yeah. Sean and I just got back a couple of weeks ago. We did a book signing together at Sebring during the 12-hour. And, Sean, I think you should tell them the story about being arrested by the Chinese Communist police while touring and trekking in Tibet with a bunch of philosophy students. There's a lot more to Sean. I mean, he's a lot to look at, but there's even more when you dig into his brain.
Yeah, he is. I will say that.
Well, I'll try to make it short. I had a group of 16 students with me going through Nepal and Tibet. And at one point we did, after being in the Everest region for a few weeks, we did a bus tour from Kathmandu to Lhasa, Tibet. And along the way, we were at a monastery, which I've since found out is actually very famous for Chinese government spies. But at the time, one of the people on the trip was handing the monks money rolled up in pictures of the Dalai Lama or vice versa, whatever it was, which is highly illegal. And at one point, shortly after that, the army pulled in front of our bus and came up to my window and tuck, 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 get off the bus, you're in big trouble. And, you know, there I was being interrogated. So, yeah.
You know, there was a better story with the margaritas.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thankfully, I didn't have to do any time there, and I, you know, we all made it out, and
you're lucky.
And yeah, sure we're.
Well, that covers all that on that question.
More than
what are you working on now? Everybody, what you working on now?
This is Jonathan. I'm working on a book with Mark Rathoff that's for Octane Press, and it's the follow-up to the book that Mitch Bishop and Mark did on John Bishop, IMSA 1969 to 1989, how John Bishop created the world's greatest sports car series. And so Mark has undertaken to write the follow-up, which would be IMSA 1990 to 1999, along with George Silberman. And it's kind of about, it's about how they sort of kept the sanctioning body going through five different changes in ownership. You know, and at least one of those owners has ended up in jail, and another is sought after. So, you know, that's what I'm working on currently. And I'm copy editing that book, so I copy edited the Bishop book, and this one's called American Sports Car Racing Survives Turbulence and Change, the Inside Story. So that's what we're working on now. That should be out prior to the 24 hour next year.
Yay, that's fast work.
Yeah, we've been on it for several months.
That's still fast work.
Yeah, Mark he's got a lot. He knows where all the bodies are buried, and so does George.
That's right. So, yes, he does.
It's interesting. I learned stuff. You know, I covered the 90s IMSA racing. I shouldn't say I covered the 90s in the 1990s, I covered IMSA racing for On Track, and I'm already just a couple chapters along, and I'm learning things I didn't know previously. So all of which are very, very interesting.
I like it. Sean, what are you working on now?
Well, we just finished up the Brumos collection of books, which is 1,600 pages with 2,900 images. So I took a little break for a while to kind of recover from that, and now I'm working on a book for Renee Brinkerhoff, who is the woman who just back in December completed her quest to drive her 1957 Porsche 356A on all seven continents. So we're working on writing and laying that out now, optimally we'll have it out in the late summer, but with the printing industry right now, it's really hard to say.
That is fascinating. We need to get her on the show.
Yeah, she's Renee's a great person. I met her back in 2013 when she had, I think, just completed her first or second La Carrera Panamericana, and then a couple of years later she came up with this idea, and we all kind of thought she was a little crazy. Can you even go to Antarctica? But it turns out you can, and she completed all of them very successfully, and she has some great photos and great stories, and really quite an adventurous lady who has been popular on the talk circuit lately too.
Neat. I love it. Wow. What are you doing, Bert?
First of all, my series, which are, for those that don't know, they're essentially historical novels. I started out literally sitting by the pool with a massive rum hangover at the 1986 Bahamas Vintage Grand Prix, where I was driving for Joe Marchetti in a car that he bankrolled and I built, basically, and raced. And I had this idea of writing a novel about racing for a long time because I hated all the fiction I'd ever read about racing. It didn't ring true. It didn't capture... Yeah. Either the lifestyle or the humor and the characters. I mean, you can be whoever you dream of being on a race weekend if you can pull it off. And I started the last open road there with no plan, no outline, no nothing, and it took me 8 years because basically I didn't know how to write a book. And then that led to a sequel, and that led to another sequel. So there were four books in that series. Then there's the three more that are an extension of that series, the Steamroller books, which are a highly fictionalized and hopefully entertaining account of Ford's attempt to buy Ferrari and subsequent assault on Le Mans. And I finished the last one. It debuted in paperback preview edition in July at Road America, where all the books have been introduced. And then it came out for real in October. And there's going to be one more in that series, and I need probably another year and a half to 2 years to finish it. It's a pretty long process. And then we did an audiobook version of The Last Open Road done in the style of a 1950s radio play with music, sound effects, professional voice actors. I went all over the country and recorded the actual cars that are in the story. And then we got mystery celebrity guest voices in a lot of the parts. And they're just people that like my books, including, David Hobbs, Brian Redman, Tommy Kendall, Patrick Long, Skip Barber, Ray Evernham, John Doonan and his son. They all did parts. And someday we're going to have a contest to see who can figure out the most of them. And we've gotten such good feedback on that people are asking me, When are you going to do the rest of the books? And seeing as how that one took me 3 years and cost something on the order of $100,000, I haven't quite decided yet. But we'll see. It was a fun thing to do.
Looking forward to the next episode of your life there. That's great.
Thank you. Next.
George.
Yeah, well, I am in the process of finishing up the biography of Jim Hall of Chaparral fame. We've been working on that together over the last several years, and it's very exciting to be bringing that to completion.
When will we see it?
Probably the end of the year or early next year, like Sean was saying, the print schedules these days are a little bit in flux.
What about it is in flux? I'm not close enough to know that.
Well, Sean can probably answer that better than I can. But just supply chain issues, paper. You talk to printers and. It used to be pick any paper in the world that you possibly want, any weight, any gloss, anything. These days, it's like, well, here are the six different papers we could do.
Yeah, if you can get them. And then on top of that, getting on a print schedule, because so many of the books that might have gone to Asia or Europe in the past several years are coming back to the U.S. printers, and now they're their print queues are what used to maybe be a month or two are now 6 or 7 or 10 or 12 or maybe even 15 months out.
Wow.
That's crazy. We've got to do reprints on two of my titles. And my regular printer, who I've used over the years because they always gave good service, they're quoting me September delivery on a reprint.
Wow.
I mean, it's crazy. And some of the mill that supplies them their, quote, house, unquote, paper went out of business. And this is all, issues in the wake of the pandemic and the way the marketplace has changed. I think that I originally resisted putting my books on Kindle. I said, I like to hold a book in my hand, and I can't take my computer into the John. And, I was at a race, and a friend of mine about the same age as me came up. He said, you got to put your books on Kindle. I said, what for? These are about the 50s and 60s. It just doesn't seem right. He said, Bert, I can hit a button and make the type bigger.
That is true. I will say that. And that's kind of important when you get to be my age. But
there is one bright spot to the bottleneck in printing is that, some of the books that are already out there are continuing to enjoy a good life. The Formula One book that Pete Biro, my late partner, and I did remains in the top 10 at Amazon like 3 years or so after it came out, which is just crazy from our perspective.
Yeah, that is good. We built slowly over time, but the first book, The Last Open Road, which was turned down by every publisher in New York, is heading into its 11th printing now. That's one of the ones we have to reprint. And the conventional wisdom in the publishing world is that a novel has a shelf life of maybe 6-7 months. A new novel. And so, it's a testament to the people that have said, oh, I like this, even though the publishers all told us in the beginning, you can't sell that. Those people don't read. And it turns out they do.
Yep.
What a terrible thing to say about the public.
Well, New York's not a car town. What can I tell you? And most the fiction publishing world is in New York.
Who was the craziest person you ever had to interview?
Ooh, somebody else take this. I got to sort through a lot of candidates.
Well, I can start on that one, but and I'm not sure this is really the response you're looking for, but clearly for me, the craziest guy was A.J. Foyt, and that was because I hadn't really talked to him previously and one-on-one. And, you know, everybody knows A.J., and A.J. and I have been friends for, I guess, what would it be now, over 30 years, closer to 40. So it's kind of a unique circumstance, but I think that's what makes for crazy interviews, basically, and I'm not sure it requires a crazy person as much as maybe a circumstance, and others may have something along those lines. But yeah, so I was there with AJ at Sebring in the pits with the swap shop Porsche. At the time, there were, you know, tents in the sand, basically, where teams set up. And, you know, Preston Hinn saw me, and he came over, and he had this Xerox copy of one of my story in On Track from the Miami race. And there was a line of type in that story that said Foyt broke the car. And so Preston introduced me to AJ by saying, Jonathan, you know, he's the one that he wrote this story. And he had this copy with a highlight. One line was not a sentence, just a line of type across the column, you know, that Foyt broke the car. And there's like a very long paragraph explaining why he broke the car and that he was leading and his job was just to go for broke and so forth. And, you know, that was all left out in Preston's presentation. So, so AJ got a little agitated and he asked me, you know, why I would write something so stupid like that. And I was pretty hacked off at Preston. I was very hacked off at Preston because he thought he'd get AJ wound up by pushing around this skinny writer. And, so I, you know, I stepped closer to AJ and I said, well, you know, why did the car break when it broke? And, cause I was pretty hot at Preston and I wasn't in the mood for chatting. And, so I forgot I was talking to AJ, and then Bob Wallach, who was part of this deal, jumped in and nudged me in the ribs and pointed to AJ and said, he turned the boost up too high, you know, so now AJ was agitated. So it went on from there, but it was not fun. And I had some bruises when I got back to the Kenilworth. But you know, AJ and I talked later. We made up, and I think some people went to AJ and said, you know, this is the wrong guy to try to be beating up. And I, at the end of the day, there was a war of words, and I kind of, we, that was a draw at least. So, anyhow, that was lucky.
You know, yeah, you're probably the,
that's pretty crazy.
So. You're probably the only guy that ever saw AJ Foyt agitated.
Oh yeah.
Well, I was so agitated at Preston, I forgot who I was talking to. So,
yeah.
I, you know, it went downhill from there. But he was using three syllable words, and you know, it was 11 a.m. and I just wasn't up for that. So. You know, so that was a crazy circumstance. So, you know, that's what I think creates crazy interviews, not necessarily crazy people. So have at it, anybody else.
Yes, please.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm waiting.
Well,
all
I
right.
Can give you one.
Who day?
Go.
This is George. You know, in doing the Jim Hall book, I was, you know, you're looking at all the guys here probably have the same experience of, you know, some of the people that you're looking to interview are, if you're doing a book, are easy to find, and some are pure detective cases. And there was a photographer who took most of the good pictures I had seen of Jim Hall's early career, who I wanted to find, his name was Bob Jackson. And, you know, this goes back into the 50s, and so I figured, well, I'm looking for his archive. And everybody I interviewed about Jim, I asked, well, did you ever hear of this guy named Bob Jackson? And, you know, most of them did not or had not or said, yeah, I remember that name from a long time ago, but that's about it. And I was just about to give up, and the last person on my list at the end of a conversation, oh, by the way, did you ever know a photographer named Bob Jackson? Do you remember that name at all? And do you know what happened to his archive? And there was a pause, and he goes, something happened to Bob? And I'm like, well, hold on, wait a second. Is Bob still around? And he goes, yeah, I talk to him a couple times a year. And I said, well, no, I just assumed that he was gone, but no, I don't want to alarm you. And he gives me Bob's contact information, and we're just about to hang up the phone. And he goes, by the way, you do know who Bob Jackson is, right? Like, no, other than this photographer who took some of these shots of Jim way back when. He goes, you know that shot of Jack Ruby shooting Lee Harvey Oswald?
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
That's Bob Jackson. And 15 minutes later, I was talking to a guy who was an amazing guy, an amazing photographer as well, who was in the motorcade that Friday afternoon, that awful Friday, and was there taking that famous photo a couple days later.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, my turn.
Oh, yeah, but I'm just getting over having my brain
problem.
Go ahead.
Well, the thing about fiction is particularly mine, historical fiction, most of the people I wrote about passed away. The few that I could get a hold of, I wanted to talk to Fred Wacker about that accident at Watkins Glen in 52. And that was very difficult for him. He didn't want to talk about it. It's in the book, and I actually attributed it to one of my fictional characters because it worked out better. But of the people I've met and interviewed for magazine stories and stuff or just got to know, I put Tolia Rutinoff, who a conversation with him is like watching the ball in a pinball machine bouncing off one flipper, one special, one bell, one ding, drops in a hole, pops out, goes someplace else. Just a very bright guy, but wow. And a guy that, I'm sorry?
Opinionated.
Yeah. But not so that he notices it. And, and the other one, similar deal, would be another author and a race driver, a very good one, Mike Kaiser. Mike, you meet him and talk to him, and you think, my God, this guy is all over the lot. He's really bright, but he can't keep focused on one thing for more than 10 seconds at a time. And yet you look what the guy created, his books, his videos, Speed Merchants, A French Kiss with Death. He's done brilliant work. And he's a neat guy, but he's just one of these preoccupied geniuses that's, whatever he's thinking, 2 seconds from now it'll be something else.
Yeah, this is Sean. I'll pick it up from there. First of all, I have to say that my experience is far less than the rest of the guys on the show tonight. But what I always say is that. I read car magazines most of my life as if they're comic books. In other words, they were a total fantasy, and I never expected to be a part of that world in any way, shape, or form other than vicariously. But when I started, getting involved and started doing these, doing interviews for the books and so on, or articles, I was always amazed that these guys would even talk to me. But one that kind of stands out was an interview that I did with Chuck Stoddard, and who has since passed away. But Chuck, you know, when he would talk to me, he'd say, "Well, you know, I don't really have a lot of time to talk about this stuff, and you know, I'm busy." But and then he would start talking, and he would go on and on and on and on. And just about the time, you know, things would trail off, I'd think, well, you know, thank you very much for your time, Mr. Well, you know, and then he would go on and on and on. Wow, Mr. Stott, thank you. This is really, well, you know, and about, you know, 2.5 hours later, you're thinking, well, that, you know, it's a good thing he didn't have any time.
Yeah, I've never met him, but I know that guy.
I love
That's
it.
That's funny.
You got a lot of material, whether you wanted it or not.
Yeah.
The hard part's always in the editing.
Anybody got a question for another writer?
Yeah, I have one for Sean. You have my utmost admiration. As I understand it, you were jobless and broke, and you bought a Porsche. So how did that happen?
Well,
one of the many homeless Porsche owners.
Usually they're homeless after they own it for a while. but, well, you know, it was kind of this deal where I was actually not looking for a Porsche at all. I lived in Durango, Colorado, and I was skiing a lot, and I was looking for something like a WRX, you know, a high-performance four-wheel drive car. And this buddy of mine kept bugging me about Porsches, and he says, you should really find and this was true when he said it. He said, you can find some great deals on some older Porsches. Of course, now you can't, but and I thought, that's not what I want. At the time, I visited, my girlfriend was living up in Boulder, Colorado at the time, and I saw a Carrera 4 in the paper, and I went out and drove it, and I was leaving my job in Durango and about to move to Boulder, and so I drove the car, and I thought, you know, do I want a $40,000 Subaru or this Porsche? And so I bought the Porsche, and later that day, she got downsized from IBM, and all our plans of setting up housekeeping in Boulder went awry, and there I was with no job and no place to live, but I had a Porsche. but it was that Porsche that, you know, got me into the Porsche Club of America, and the region I joined needed a newsletter editor, and you know, I started pumping out 40 pages a month of newsletter, and then that, you know, eventually turned into submitting articles to the magazines, and eventually went from doing one or two articles a year to doing three or four or five a month, and eventually that led to this idea of doing a book, which at the time was going to be on Peter Gregg, but you know, eventually turned out to be Hurley's book.
Yeah, cool. You know, I also have a question for Bert. You know, I recall quite a while back reading a short story that you wrote that had a coming-of-age kind of short story about, and it had Barney Oldfield, I think, in the story, visiting a family somewhere along his barnstorming route. And evidently,
are you sure I wrote that?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember.
Well, the question I have is, do you write short stories, and where can we access the short
stories? There's a collection called A Potside Companion, with a picture of a guy in a helmet sitting on a toilet using the plunger with a helmet on, using the plunger for a stick shift with one hand and holding up a magazine. Obviously, my short story book with the other, and that's available, you know, Amazon. It's available, but that doesn't ring a bell. But that doesn't mean I didn't do it. I'm trying to remember. There's, you know, I've been at this a long time, and I'm sure that other people on this panel have had this happen where someone will come up to you and say, "You remember that thing you wrote, blah 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 blah," and you're sitting there going, "Jesus, I don't remember that at all." And I used to drink a lot, so it may have something to do with it. Those days are hopefully behind me. They got me in trouble with the law. Let's see. At Laguna Seca, at Watkins Glen, and at Elkhart Lake. Do you sense a theme here? So those days are hopefully over.
Okay, and then I guess I commented on it earlier. Again, this is Jonathan, but do you have any tips about creating sympathetic characters like Buddy Palumbo?
You know, and I think that this is true for any fiction writer, even if it's historical fiction based on fact. You have, or I have, and I think most writers would say the same thing, it comes to you. I mean, you have an idea where you're going, but when the characters start taking over in your head, you're just, I was on a panel with a bunch of other writers, not car writers, I mean novelists, at some library, and one of the ladies said, when it's going good, you're just the tube it flows through. And
right.
I think that's really true. Just for me, anyway.
That's inspiration. If you want to write fiction, just keep at it, and you'll get into the tube. So,
I'd like to take up that. This is Sean Cridlin. I'd like to take up that question a bit. Of course, mine isn't writing fiction, but nonetheless, you know, in writing the history of Brumos Racing, one of the most controversial characters in IMSA history was Peter Gregg. And of course, he was known as Peter Perfect and not always for the best reasons, was known to have somewhat of a contemptuous attitude towards journalists and lots of other people who crossed his path. But the fact was that when you talk to his former crew members, Mike Colucci, Paul Willison, Jack Atkinson, and several others, that they all loved him dearly. Jim Busby was the first person who ever said to me that he loved Peter and that in spite of his shortcomings that he misses him greatly. And then, of course, you know, when you look at the pictures of him with his family when he was really young, even before racing and then in the early days of his racing, you can tell that there's a great amount of love there. And so for me, it was a challenge to kind of tell the entire arc of that story and how he became who he became and the reasons why he did. And then it was, of course, a sad ending. But for a lot of people, and I have to say for a lot of the stories that I read, magazine articles and such about Peter, they never really took on all the various sides of Peter. It was usually about his mercurial personality and why he was unlikable and so on and so forth. And for me, that was just not an acceptable path to take. I wanted to tell his whole story.
Well, I think that the demands of racing, you know, I don't mean just the financial and physical demands. You have to be mentally in a position where that is the most important thing to you. Otherwise, you can't do it. I just finished reading not the greatest literature, but a wonderful book, the book that Gordon Kirby did about Jim McGee, who was crew chief for, oh my God, Penske and Newman Haas and Pat Patrick and Clint Brawner, and he talks about all the drivers that went through, and he does it very matter-of-factly. It's really well done, but you come to realize what unique people and how uniquely driven they are, you know, compared to your average person. That's a free plug for Gordon's book, but it's good.
It does sound good. And it would put a lot of things in perspective, yes. Anybody else got questions for your co-guest tonight?
Let me think. Jonathan, you said publishers came looking for you. I'm so envious. How did that come about? I mean, which publishers, they came to you with a book project, or you had an idea already and they said, oh, let's do this?
I think that's what happened. They had an idea, and they thought I could fulfill the idea. And it was each circumstance was unique. And, again, I need to emphasize being in the right place at the right time, because I had been working for magazines throughout the 90s, everything, Auto Week,
right.
Sports Illustrated, On Track, Auto Sport. And so people knew me, and some in the case of, people knew Don Panos, let's say, and they knew Don had, you know, was anxious to make things happen, and he had a huge budget, and that's another story why he had this huge budget. It's kind of more interesting or more detailed than most people.
He was a chain smoker that invented the nicotine patch.
Well, yeah, somebody suggested, alas, I digress, but, you know, we're all writers here. And so somebody, Scott Atherton, talked Don into the fact that he needed to do a book, and then Scott suggested me. That would be an occasion in 2008, and this would be, I did my first book in 2000, so I'm jumping ahead. But so that's how that happened. I sat down with Don, and I said, I'll show up in Australia. We'll sit down. And he's always inviting people to come stay in his guest house behind his cabana, he called it, behind his house at Surfer's Paradise. I said, yeah, I'll show up, and we'll do this book. And so I learned a lot about Don, and Don became a billionaire by helping some friends run a active pharmaceutical ingredient company out of the Guernsey Islands after he left the pharmaceutical business, Elan, and took the royalties for the nicotine patch with him. But that was another story, because Don bought the company that created the patch, and he just, you know, perfected it and marketed it, and then defended it and forced other people legally to pay royalties to him. So that's when he left the company, because he had those royalties from Elan. But then he struck it really rich with some friends in the pharmaceutical business after that. So Don had just tons of money, basically. So somebody talked him into the 2000 book. Does relate to Don. It's the 2000 book that I did on the LMP1 Roadster. Mauro Baldi, the driver, also had a publishing company. Who knew? And he was publishing the yearbooks for the Grand Am. In the startup days, they'd have a hardback book that they'd give out at the banquet, and he wanted to branch out. And so he knew that, as a lot of people knew, that Don was somewhat of an easy touch. So he talked Don into doing a book on the LMP1 Roadster, and he came to me, and we just, you know, I said, this is the figure and so forth. And we sat down, we had one brief meeting with Don Panos, and Don said, I need it in time for Le Mans. That was at Sebring. So, you know, many burned the midnight oil to get that one out. And basically, Mauro had, like so many Italian men and so many race car drivers and so many Italian race car drivers, he had a mistress, and he traveled with her, Elena Rasconi, and she was a graphic arts and production expert. So doing books was a way to spend time working with Elena. So that was part of their relationship. So that's I was there writing all the time, or interviewing Mauro from time to time while he was racing. And so he knew where to find me. So that's how that one came about. And then the second one was on Dale Earnhardt, and Dale was killed. I was devastated. I'd reported on him his entire career. I'd gotten to be friendly with him. And, I didn't want to do a book. And then every time I turn around, there'd be a book out by somebody who'd never met the man. And so I got a call from Carlton Books in London, and they called me because one of my colleagues at Autosport magazine, they'd called him, Bruce Jones. Thank you, Bruce. You know, I'm forever grateful. And he suggested they call me, and they called me and said, we have this style of book that we do. We've done it on Kobe Bryant and Kournikova, the female tennis player. And we'd like to do this style of book on Dale Earnhardt. It's called a fanzine. And it was a brilliant idea, and they were going to have it on the checkout stands at Kmart, Walmart, and Target. And it was really, really cool, perfect bound, not exactly a hardback, not exactly a paperback, and lots of photos and stuff. So they said, well, you know, I said, well, how much do you pay? And they gave me a figure, and I said, well, you don't understand. This is Dale Earnhardt. If you double that, you know, I'll do the book. And so they called back. They said, do you have a resume? I sent in my resume. The guy at Carlton Books, Martin Cortile, and, you know, he called back a couple of days later and said, yeah, we'd like to proceed. So that's how I did my first Earnhardt book, and then that led to another Earnhardt book from Motor Books, and then that led to another book on Danica Patrick from Motor Books, and, you know, I did one more for Carlton. So that's on NASCAR history is told in a photo book format. So that's kind of how that all unfolded. But part of it was I did dedicate myself to doing a good job with the books. I think that was part of it. But mostly it was, you know, right place, right time. And there were it was a time when racing books really somehow were catching hold with publishers. Not sure exactly why, but, you know, there were a lot of publishers looking for people to write racing books. So, you know, after that, I began branching out on my own. I did the book with Bob Riley was my next book, and it was, I think, 4 years before after the Danica Patrick book, before I actually landed my deal. So, you know,
I like Riley and his son. I was covering IMSA and Trans Am in the Midwest for, I think it was on track. And I remember looking at the Roush Mercours. You remember those? And you look at those with the skin off, and it looked like a space capsule. And you looked at a Riley car with the skin off, and it was like a Group 44 car. It was so simple. Yeah, you know, it looked like, well, what's so trick about this? And I thought that was really cool. And they've been big supporters of my books. If you look on the back of that Mercedes that they're running currently, there's a Last Open Road decal, which is really nice.
You know, speaking of Bob Riley, that was the most interesting. I don't know, Don Panos is pretty interesting, but and all these guys that are driven, as we mentioned before, as I think we've already talked about, and Bert, you mentioned, they're all driven and beyond in terms of the Jim McGee book and all the drivers he worked with. They're all very driven people and very strong, well put together people, let's say, who believe in themselves and are dedicated. So, you know, and Bob was one of the more interesting deals because I would sit down with Bob, and then I wrote the book in Bob's voice because I thought that was the best way to get to who he was and how he did things and do an engaging book about his cars. And I think that worked out pretty well. But Bob was really a genius. And, he would sit, lay in bed in the mornings, and he would do 3D designs in his head before he ever got to the shop. And he was doing his second car on our third car on AJ Foyt, and actually the 73 Coyote that was turned out to be so successful and that AJ drove to his fourth Indy 500 victory. And Bob was unhappy with that car, and he would take a month off to go to Houston to work on the car on the drawing board. This would be the early 70s. In AJ's shop, along with all the fabricators there, and he was unhappy with the car, and he took his drawings, he went and tore them up and went home and decided to just do it all at home after his time ran out. He'd get a month off from Ford to do the cars for AJ. So, you know, somebody asked him how he could do that while he was in the process. One of his fellow Ford engineers, and Bob said, you know, everybody can't do that. Everybody can't imagine things in 3D in their head. Don't we all do that? And, you know, so Bob, he was such an humble guy, but also so bright. It was really a delight to sort of try to tease out how he did things. And we would always, we'd get to a point where Bob would say, all right, that's enough. That's all I'm going to say, because it would just get too complicated.
You know,
I guess this is not going to be a how-to book, you know, so...
Just to take a little springboard off of what you just said, even though none of us in this group wrote it, Adrian Newey's book, How to Design a Car, is absolutely fabulous. He takes you on his journey of discovery about aerodynamics, and you don't have to be super, super technical to follow it. And it is just brilliant, and it's brutally honest, just like the Sean's book about Hurley Haywood. It's brutally honest about his personal life as well. It's just so well done. When Bill Warner from the Amelia Island Concourse was having a little health problem and was laid up for a little while, I sent him a copy of it. And he liked it well enough that he bought, I think, 6 or 7 copies to give to other people.
Oh,
yeah.
I need to do a station identification. You got a few minutes here? Just give me a second. I gotta break in for a moment. And now a word from our sponsor. This is Race Talk with Trish, brought to you by Dave Walland and the Racing History Project. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com. Okay. I interrupted somebody, and I apologize.
No, I've already talked too much and about books that none of us wrote, so somebody else.
This is Sean Cridlin. Jonathan, I want to ask you a question, and I guess I could ask Bert this too, because this is something he does on a regular basis. But, you know, Jonathan, when I took on Hurley's book, as anybody who knows Hurley will tell you, he's a man of few words usually. He's somewhat shy, and you know, to take on that project in his voice was quite a challenge. And just to give you a quick synopsis, I remember asking him at one point, okay, Hurley, so you know, you're at Le Mans for the very first time, you're with the Porsche team, which is heavily favored, you're teamed with Jackie Eakes, you're in a 936, which is an open car. You're not haven't been an open car since the Can-Am. You're on the Mulsanne Straight for the very first time. You know, give me a description of what that was like. And Hurley says, that was cool. And, of course, at this point I'm thinking, well, now we have a pamphlet. So the question or the challenge really was how to tell Hurley's story in his voice and to extrapolate all of these stories into real life events that are things that he's done, but I'm essentially the one who's pulling the stories out and developing them. So Jonathan, you mentioned that you were telling Bob Riley's story in his voice. So tell
right.
me a little bit about how you go about doing that.
Yeah, that's pretty straightforward. And of course, you in this case, I would drive to Charlotte, and we would sit down, and I'd arrive midday. We'd work through the afternoon, and then perhaps go to dinner or not. And then I would go to a nearby motel, and then come back the next day and start in the morning. We do a morning session, then an afternoon session, and then I would drive back to Atlanta. So, we'd do it 3 sessions at a time, and, of course, I had all the background. One of the things about working with Bob is our careers kind of ran parallel, particularly once he got into you know, the Trans Am and IMSA. So what I do is I transcribe my own, you know, sessions from our sit-down conversations. And, of course, just as you mentioned with Hurley, you had all the details in place to ask the question, you know, and that's what you always try to do. So I would transcribe those conversations myself. I think that was critical, because then I would once again sit down with Bob in terms of transcribing the interviews. And it's you know, if an interview lasts for 3 hours or a session, let's say, then it's times three. That's 9 hours of work to transcribe it. And I couldn't imagine sending them out, but that's basically how I get the voice. And then you just sort of, to go back to what Bert's talking about, you sort of get in the tube. You sort of get to the point where you can imitate how he does things, his syntax and key phrases he uses, and well enough, and sometimes just literally. You just literally lift from what he says on the tape and build a sentence around that. So I think the key thing is doing the transcription of the sessions myself.
And
not farming it out. I would love to do that, but it's a lot less work, but it just doesn't get the result I would be looking for.
Well, I think that, for anybody that wants to tell a story. I mean, if you're a writer, you're supposed to be a storyteller. And you can listen to people talk about this or that happened. But the art of it, the technique of it, is you have to find the story inside everything that's being said. Where is the spinal column, if you will, that makes this something that a reader can follow and wants to listen to. And I've had cases, mostly with magazine articles, where I'm hunting around trying to find that. And then when the light goes on, all of a sudden it gets easy.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, and I would say with doing the art of race car design, there was somewhat of a format. You know, how did this car come about? What were the challenges? What were all the background, the details? What did you have conflicts with Roush? Did you have conflicts with Kranifus? You know, how did you get to know Gary Pratt and Charlie Seelix? What were their roles? What was it like working with them? So it kind of lends itself to storytelling because, you know, you're talking about the cars over his career, and then you build around that. But yeah, so that was an easy, to use your phrase, that's an easy sort of spinal cord through it all, and then you just press for details. And
I think the other thing, and I think this applies to racing, I mean, why are we all obsessed with it? Because I think outside of mechanized warfare, there's nothing in human experience that combines the, you know, the animal side of man with the scientific side of man, like racing. And I also think there's nothing outside of mechanized warfare that has a sense of mission and accomplishment. It's just really, really special that way.
And teamwork.
Yeah, I think of wheels turned in anger. So I would tend to agree with that, and it's about one guy trying to decimate, you know, however many other starters there are in the field, basically. So that's really the satisfaction. I just want to, you know, all these guys are going to have to look up to me after I whip their butts. So
yeah.
I think that's what drives the drivers.
This is okay. Sean. For me, when I was working on, you know, starting Hurley's book, you know, I had looked at many of the kinds of books that we all enjoy when I was getting ready to put this together. But the thing for me was, how do I make this book different? In other words, Okay, so yeah, we go to battle. We race against the elements. We face death. We try to go faster or break later or whatever it is. And I just thought to myself, that's great, and I guess I can do that, but I don't want to. So I, after interviewing for several months and still not having a publisher, I met Hurley at the Ren Sports in Laguna Seca in 2015. And he says, yeah, come on into the transporter here. So we sat down in the little office there. And he says, he said, I haven't told you, but Patrick Dempsey is making this film about my life. And I, you know, me trying to make this book, I automatically think, wow, ka-ching, you know, that's great because now we're going to get more publicity and this is, you know, this is going to put us on the road here. And then he says, and it's going to talk about what it was like to be a gay racing driver in the 1970s. And I thought to myself, why would I do that? Because I didn't know at the time. And then he said, but, you know, I never really had any trouble with that. And then I thought to myself, wait, did he just tell me what I thought he told me? And this is in my bit in the back of Hurley's book about our meeting then. And I'll it's hard to describe without having my hands here to show you, but my hand actually came up to the table as I locked eyes with Hurley. And I locked eyes with him because I didn't want him to see my hand with a death grip because I actually thought I was going to pass out. I really did think I was going to pass out because my head was just swirling. But after that subsided, it occurred to me that I had a much better book. I mean, I had a much better book because, yes, it was about racing, and, yes, it was about this character who had raced at Le Mans, who had won Le Mans three times, had won Daytona five times, who won at Sebring, who won championships, and obviously had this kind of killer competitive instinct. But he had this life that was an entirely human life behind all of that. And for me, that made the whole thing more fascinating. And then to incorporate the kinds of struggles that he went through personally, and to work through them and to maintain the kind of grace that Hurley has throughout all of that. And we all know Hurley and the kind of person he is. For me, that was the most interesting thing. That's what really made that project worth doing.
Yeah, you were the only guy in the paddock that didn't know.
That's right, yeah. But see, I wasn't in the paddock. And in fact, one of my questions to him after we were all done was, you know, there are probably 50 or 60 people at Daytona walking up and down pit lane who could have or maybe even should have done that. Why me?
Well, I remember Bob Carlson, the late motorsports guy from Porsche, who was a wonderful character. He actually invited me to a presentation of their new cars. It was the year that the first Porsche Turbo Carrera came out and the Boxster S, and it was down at Texas Motor Speedway. And I got Hurley as you can't even call him an instructor because all the scribes already think they know how to drive. And I got Hurley as a passenger. And I'm trying to show off because, hey, I'm a racer. I know what I'm doing. And he looked over at me and just in the calmest, nicest voice, he said, Bert, don't be a cowboy. just a neat guy. And Bob Carlson, we were at dinner. And he said, well, you know, sometimes he goes off into Hurley world. He didn't say anything more, and I didn't know what that meant at the time. But, you know, it came to me later. And, I mean, you talk to the teams that he ran for, and they all say, you know, he was great not only because he could go fast, but he always brought the car home, and he didn't hurt the car or wreck the car. I mean, he just had tremendous control. I'm done.
Yeah, I think just to follow up on Sean's comments and some of our earlier discussions, the important thing about people at the sharp end of professional motor racing, who we are talking about often, you know, or just the people who engage in it at the club level and are dedicated and passionate about it, you know, I think the key thing to remember is not only are they driven literally and figuratively, but also they have, particularly those under a lot of pressure in professional racing, they have a lot more than one dimension to them, because that's also what it takes to survive. You know, you have to roll with the punches and develop and grow. It's not a given thing, even if you have talent, that you're going to make it. And we have seen those, you know, stories where people with tremendous talent just disappear all of a sudden. And, you know, so I think that's really the challenge in writing books, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, is bring out those other dimensions of people, and, you know, so that they, you know, that you're fair to the guy that who is the subject, but also you, at the same time, you engage the readers. So I think that's part of what people appreciate about racing, is that there are a lot of characters, and they aren't one dimensional by any means, or they likely wouldn't be racing.
Trish, yeah. Let's see if the audience has any questions.
I'm sorry? I didn't hear you, Dave.
I was asking if the audience had any questions. I don't think they do.
Okay. All right. I've got one. What's one idea that's been rambling around in your head for years that you never wrote?
Oh, my God.
I can answer that one. This is Jonathan. It's fairly, fairly easy for me. You know, when Dale Earnhardt was killed, and I am the only guy that's done three books on Dale, if you include the book Crash about, you know, how the Hans helped save racing, subtitled From Senna to Earnhardt. So, when Dale was killed, he had just run the 24-hour, co-drove with Dale Jr. and Andy Pilgrim and Collins. And so he was talking with Doug Feehan about putting together a Corvette team to race at Le Mans. And they were pretty far down the road on doing this. And, of course, you can imagine GM's response, or Doug Feehan, you know, manager of Corvette Racing. And so they were – you know, and Dale was a Chevy dealer, and he was, you know, going back to this driven aspect, you know, he was already setting himself up to be able to find something to do in retirement, beyond running a NASCAR team, running a Corvette team at Le Mans. Of course, if he was retired, he could drive at Le Mans. So that was well in the works, and something that I talked with Doug Feehan about. So the story that rattles around in my head, and I'll just do this, put it out there briefly, which is, you know, doing a story about Dale Earnhardt going to the 24-hour, and a fiction story, of course. And, you know, I'm not sure whether it be he'd come back to life, or he didn't actually get killed and nobody knew it, or just pretend that, you know, everything was okay, and what would have happened if he'd gone to Le Mans. So that's the one that rattles around in my head.
I like it. Who else has got one?
As everyone that's read my stuff knows, they're historical fiction. I try to do the research and get the history right so that my fictional characters are woven into the actual people, events, cars, venues, all that stuff, history. And believe it or not, I've started three other novels that have nothing to do with cars. And one of them that takes place in the not-too-distant future is something I've got a couple hundred pages of it. And every time I've worked on it, I said, you know something? You're obligated to yourself and to your readers to finish The Last Open Road Saga. There's one more book that I'm working on now that will complete it. It's going to end, the whole thing starts in the spring of 1952 and ends in June of 1966, and everybody on this panel knows what happened in June of 1966. And when that's done, I would like to go back and finish this story because it's a, I really enjoy it. I guess you'd call it a little bit science fiction-y, but it's really about the collector mentality. And the title is Real Balls, and it's not what you think.
All right.
Okay, yep. Sounds good to end it here, Trish.
Huh?
It sounds pretty good to wind it up here. Our audience is going away.
If you think so.
Yep.
Okay, let me do this here. All right, I guess we're going to wrap it up. All right.
Thank you.
Y'all
for
are wonderful.
Me.
Every one of you has been just a great font of information and stories. You've had all interesting lives with a long way to go. So I thank every one of you, and I thank each member of our audience. I hope you got a lot out of this. I know I did. Thanks for listening. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website. Okay, next month is going to be kind of fun. May 13th, another Wednesday. It's Fathers and Sons in Racing. And we've got Wayne Taylor and his boys, both of them. We've got Rob Dyson and Chris Dyson. And we've got Bob Lightfinger and Butch.
Wow.
This will be
quite
fun. Yeah, it's a large panel, so it's going to be a little on the hectic side because they're all going to have stories. And I have a feeling the kids are going to hear something they've never known before, I hope. And so will we, all the folks that listen. I appreciate you all joining us. Stay tuned for the next episode of Race Talk with Trish, and good night.